Should I go first?
I think I'll go yeah. first.
That'd be weird, right?
That's funny. We always made the guest introduce us, though.
I like a cold open. We should just leave all of this and make it a cold open.
Okay. What does that mean?
That's sloppy.
That means that the first thing they hear was this rambling, and then...
I'm knowing this.
I love that.
Yep, improv idea.
Well, it's probably a bad improv idea, but they hear this now, and they're just like, oh, man, it's like the calm before the storm, the backstage sort of pass, you know?
Wait, so when you say cold open, do you mean, is that a direct Studio 60 reference?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, great.
And then I go, man, this is like a crazy long-form podcast. Theme song.
Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbelt.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the UCB Long Form Conversation Podcast. It's the return of the podcast. I am Sean Diston, and with me is my co-host, Nicole Dressbelt, is how you pronounce your last name. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Good. Yeah. We have taken over for the elder statesman, and we've come in with some young, new energy. It's a new day. So if you liked the podcast before, we're just trying to give you what you want. This is a gift for you, right? Right, Nicole?
Yeah, I think that's fair. We're giving you a gift.
We're giving you a gift.
Gift giving.
And learn how to take the endowment. Lesson number one. This is going to be a disaster because for me, it's hard to not do nonstop bits when I'm on a microphone. And it's going to be hard to slow it down just a little bit.
I love that you specified it's hard when you're on a microphone.
It's hard.
Well, like
the rest of my life is kind of the same. But a microphone, there's a responsibility. But let's forget about that. Let's bring in the guest, the first guest for the reboot of this wonderful podcast. And to me, it was kind of crazy that he had never been an official guest, right,
yep.
Nicole?
Yeah, we were both really excited about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the academic advisor, I believe is the title, perennial improv all-star. They're shaking their head. No, that's not the title. Perennial improv all-star, elder statesman in the community. Some people call him the mayor. Others call him the brother of dragons. I call him Kevin Hines. Hello, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Sean. Academic supervisor.
Academic supervisor.
And then actually, associate academic supervisor.
Associate academic supervisor. I'm going to write that down. And so we've started. Hi, Kevin. Thank you.
You wrote down the letter A.
I wrote down A, and then I see it, and I was like, this is not important. I can't get into the habit of writing down nonsense during the podcast. Welcome, Kevin. Thank you for doing the podcast.
Thank you guys for doing the podcast as well. It's one of the frequent questions I get asked. When are you going to do the podcast? Because Will did it before, and he's my brother, and he was also the academic supervisor, so that means I had to do it.
Right, they expect you to take over all his jobs.
It was not something he did. It was not his job. I think John Frusciante is the main person behind the podcast, So I'm glad somebody else is doing it so I don't have to.
No more questions for you, Kevin, and great. I'm sorry if that was something that was bothering you.
What? Was that a question?
No,
it's just
a statement.
An apology.
Okay. Apology accepted.
So let's get into it. Normally, Kevin, right here at the beginning of the podcast,
No, there's no normally.
Well, I'm going off the model of the old model.
Ugh, I thought you were going to invent something new,
I did.
And you invited the oldest improviser
okay,
of theater.
Okay.
I pitched a new thing, and Sean told me it was incredibly nerdy.
No. Let's do the new thing, because I agree. We do need some new kind of energy in this thing.
That's the trick, Nicole. Ask him on the air what he would do.
And then I have to say yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Very much like an improv scene.
I like to respect people's ability to say no to
things.
Can't
do that with Sean.
Okay. I guess that's true.
Well, let's do it, Nicole.
Okay, great. So we're going to start by describing your base reality before you started taking improv classes. So who were you, where were you, and what were you doing?
So I'm going to describe my base reality.
Yes.
All right.
Yep.
That is nerdy.
And then the thing. And then the first unusual thing was your first improv class. And then the rest of the podcast will be heightening and exploring
Holy
if this
crap.
Is true. What else is true?
Holy crap.
I mean, this is, Just throw a pen at our own microphone.
Yep.
I mean, this is the audience for these sorts of questions.
Yeah, I think this is the only place that this is appropriate. I am interested. Because I do believe you came into improv a little bit later than some of the 19, 20-year-olds.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think 26 when I took my first class. Mm-hmm. 25, 26? What year was it? 2000? 15 years ago? 25. I think it was even, like, before I saw a show, I was a programmer who had just moved to New York. Had been living in Pennsylvania, and I had just moved to New York, and I was a consultant, so I flew around programming and installing SAP packages for different companies. That's my who, what, where.
Wow.
And it was a very lonely job because I was like a consultant. Like a lot of consultants work in teams, and they travel with like four or five other coworkers, and I would just go alone.
Interesting.
And I would like sit in a hotel and get up in the morning and go to work. And then, like, fly home. And I didn't know anybody in New York other than Will because I didn't live here.
Right. Was that something you sort of fell into or were you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just basically, what did you do in college?
I was a chemical engineer.
Mm.
I went to Cornell University and I took the hardest major and I barely passed. But when I graduated in 96, the economy was good. Maybe the last time you could say that.
Right.
So it was a get out of college and get a job while you can because they were just handing out jobs to anybody who had a technical background.
Because did your job have anything to do with your major?
No.
Okay.
I got a job installing SAP for Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is a pharmaceutical company and technically would hire chemical engineers. But I was not a good chemical engineer, so they didn't want me for that job. They just wanted me to be this other thing because they could train me how to do this. And they were like, you could learn this. And I could, and I was good at it.
So there's two things that stand out to me right away is the technical background, mm-hmm. right? And I wonder if you approach improv in a technical way. We'll save that question for later. And also, the fact that you were...
Just a preview of what's
just
to come.
A preview. But great. Also...
Great,
the
I don't
fact
wanna,
that
I don't
you,
wanna answer right now, so that's good.
Great.
The fact that you went from a kind of job where you were by yourself a lot or traveling by yourself... to seeing your first improv show, was that part of what drew you to improv?
I mean, I think the weird thing is I am a little bit of an introvert. I describe myself to, I think, Cassia Miller I was talking to. I said, I think I'm a social introvert because, like, I do when I'm out with people, I have fun and I enjoy people. But when I'm home, I'm like, this is cool. No one's around. This is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of need both. But, like, if I don't have, like, stretches of time where – it's just me. I do go crazy. So when I was traveling, I was like, this will work great for me.
Right.
I'm okay with this. It was just too much of it. It was 100% of it. And then I sort of like went out of my mind. But I don't know what drew me to improv. I was scared. And I think it was literally something to do. And I never believed I would do it for very long. Will did it. Will Hines, my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me to shows. He took me to Ask Cats, and then I started going to more shows, mostly with him, sometimes without him. And then he started taking classes, and I saw all his grad shows. And I think after his level 2 grad show, I was like, I'll take a class.
Do you remember the first show you saw? Because
I think,
is that the first unusual thing, Nicole, that for going on with this who, what, where analogy?
I had decided it was taking improv 101.
Taking improv. Okay, well,
yeah.
I'd still like to hear what if you remember
so, okay.
your first show.
So the first show, so Will talked about UCB nonstop to me.
Right.
And he will point this out that after I saw this show, which was unbelievably funny, my reaction was like, it was okay. and I think it was just because I went in with, like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever.
Right.
And at the time, I was like, yeah, it was very funny, but what is that? The Will points out that it changed my entire life, so it probably was the greatest thing ever. In the moment, I didn't know that. But it was Ask Cat. So this is back when the UCB4 did every Ask Cat, so they were there. Andy Richter was playing with them.
Where was it?
It was not at the 22nd Street. It was between theaters. It was after Solo Arts, just before the 22nd Street Theater opened. So they were like temporarily
space,
in this
right.
space while they were getting the 22nd Street Theater ready. They knew they were moving there, I believe. It was one of the last few shows there. Delaney did monologues because he did not do ASCAP back then, which is unbelievable to me because he was already so great.
That. It's crazy to think about that.
He was just like
that.
A friend doing monologues for them. And I don't fully remember who else was there. I bet like a lot of the Conan writers were there as well. But at the time, I didn't know who those guys were. So Andy Richter was the only one that like I was like, oh, I know him. I didn't really even know the UCB before because they weren't – I didn't watch their show that much. I'd seen a few episodes. So, but I just knew them because they introduced themselves at the top of the show. Mm-hmm. It was very funny.
And so you then, you know, when
– it was like a year later before I took a class.
Took a first
even
class.
Signed – when I and a year before I signed up probably. And when I signed up, it was another 6 months till I got in because back then you would just send a check-in saying, I want to take a class.
Right.
And
through
at some
the
point
mail.
Yes. Through the mail. And you'd at some point get in a call being like, you're in a class starting in June. And I'd be like, great.
And whatever day of the week you had to make.
You would
week.
Like write down the days you could
oh,
do.
Okay,
and they would like fit. Well, they'd find you. Like, I can't imagine our students dealing with this now. But
right.
I was like, I can do any time during the weekend or evenings. And so I got a call. It's like, I forget what it was now, but it was like Saturday morning at noon, you're in a class. I was like, all right, I'll be there.
How long were you in New York before you signed up and then before the class?
So I moved to New York at the end of 98. So I was in
for
like a year, full year and a half.
Oh, at the end of great.
But I was consulting and not here during the week for most of that. Like it was January of 2000 when I quit my job and just was in New York full time.
Wait, what did you do for money?
Nothing. I had saved up money because I got paid really well as a consultant. And I got so miserable. I had sort of a mini breakdown and then quit my job like 2 weeks later. And I was just like, I've just made all this money. I'm miserable. I don't want to work anymore.
Wow.
And I'll figure it out when I need to.
Wow. I wonder how many improv careers have begun with a mini breakdown.
A lot.
Because
I
feel like I had a similar sort of breakdown where I was like, I don't know what I've been doing. I can't do this anymore.
But again, in my mind, I was just taking those classes on a lark. I was back then, there was only three levels. I was like, I'll finish level three and then I'll be done.
You weren't trying to change your life necessarily.
I never thought I'd get on a team at that time. I was like, I'm not good enough to be on a team. I'll just take the three levels and then I'll figure out what's next.
What percentage of, I mean, jumping ahead a little bit, how many people would audition and then how many spots would
there be?
There
were no auditions.
Then? Okay.
So when I took my first class, Armando Diaz, I think, just recommended people for teams and to put them on teams. And that was it. Like when Will got on his first team, he was just put on it. When Chris Gethard and I think Chris Gethard was one of the last few to get just put on a team. His Joe Ross tribe, I think, was just a team that was put together. I'm not sure if he was the last, but he was because he was in my level one. And after that, it became auditions.
Was Shannon also on that team?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
This is where Will Hines would be.
I'm relatively sure she was.
Okay.
And she was also – and she took level one the same time as Chris and I.
Right.
Can you walk me through what
Wait,
it was?
Wait, so you'd get on after level one? Sorry.
No, this is after level three.
Gotcha. Right. Okay.
But they took – back then, all classes started the same time. So all level ones started like this week. And then they'd all end. And once they all were done, there'd be a short break. And then another round of classes would start. So – And then almost a lot of people just would go into the next one. Mm-hmm. And so you had like a graduating class.
Right.
So Chris Gethard and me and Shannon and a few other people like Kevin Cragg were just faces I saw every class. And I would go to everyone's class shows.
Right.
And it would be the same people. And like it was five 101s or five ones. There weren't. And then there was three twos.
Wow.
And three threes, I think. And they added a second two. They only put up two because they didn't think they needed a third one.
Right.
But so many people kept going from one. They're like, oh, we need a third one. And that was the one I got into.
So when you talked about generations back then, it really meant something very
definitive. You really had a class. And I do think that I'm sad that's missing, though I understand why it's missing. But like I'll always look at Gethard and Shannon, even if they don't – I don't know whether they do. But I'm like, oh, yeah, that's my class. Those are
right.
my guys.
It's
they got on teams way, way, way before me. So in some senses, they don't feel like my class. But I was like, I was in level one with Chris Gethard. I saw him when he was like eight doing improv.
Can you talk a little bit about just the experience of what those classes were like? Because I feel like The classes that I went through and the classes that are happening now weren't that different, but I know that...
They were pretty different.
Very different.
Because there was no curriculum. There was no written curriculum. So the teachers did... The teachers might have their own individual curriculums.
Might.
I don't know. I didn't ask them. But everyone was doing different stuff. Now, Kevin Mullaney taught a lot of the level ones. So a lot of the level one people had the same thing. And Delaney taught a lot of the level twos.
So that... Yeah.
I did not have Delaney for level two. So I did not have the same level two that most people had. And then level three was mostly Armando at that time. And that was so – maybe all Armando.
And for someone who didn't really have an acting background or a performance background, what was your experience in the class as far as like your thoughts leaving class? Were you like, this seems weird, or was it revelatory, or
– I liked it. I mean, even though I didn't have an acting background, I was a comedy nerd. So it wasn't like –
Right.
I was coming in blind. And I think to be at the UCB at that time, you wouldn't even know about it if you didn't have some nerdiness to you. You weren't just going to hear it. You didn't. No one had a friend doing improv back then in New York. It was like if you had a friend doing improv, it's because you were in class with him or because you did stand up with him, or you just like you were somehow already doing it almost.
Right. Nobody read a think piece about how improv's a good thing to do as an actor.
I went to UCB for a year before I took my first class, so I knew what I was getting into.
Right.
I wasn't good at it. I felt like I was okay at it, and I was very into it, and I was very into the post-class bar discussions.
Oh, interesting.
That's where I think I really excelled.
When do you think that started happening, like in 101? In
level one?
Yeah.
I don't know if the first class, but very early on I would go out to the bar with Dave Lombard and Chris Ward, MC Chris, and sometimes other people, and we would just discuss stuff, and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then
most like, oh, that scene was good and that scene wasn't. And like, oh, why was it? Why did this scene not work? What are we doing? How does this doesn't make any sense? What does this term mean? I don't know what's happening.
So how much improv did you do back then? Like, was it one class a week and then you saw shows? Were there practice groups? Were there indie teams?
So my level one, we started doing a practice group. I don't remember when, but like halfway through. And we did one without a coach.
Terrible.
We didn't know. No one told us. And it was awkward. It started very slow and weird, and we got into it. It was okay. No notes. We just did scenes.
That's
and I do remember feeling like, oh, I'm a little more comfortable now. It was such a weird thing. It was in somebody's apartment. It's my least favorite type of rehearsal now. By the time it was the only rehearsal I'd done. It was like the richest guy in the class's apartment, so it was an amazing apartment that also made you feel bad about yourself. And then shortly thereafter, we started getting Chad Carter to coach us. Because somebody in the class knew him, and that's probably why they were taking classes. I don't remember her name because I'm bad with names. But she started getting Chad to coach us, and that was huge. I didn't realize how huge, but that's why I'm still doing improv probably is because I was in that practice group.
That first practice group. Right.
Because that practice group, then when level one ended, we started a practice group to keep us going until level two started. And Kevin Mullaney, our level one teacher, taught that practice group. I asked him about this. I just saw him recently, and I mentioned this to him. He doesn't remember it at all. Mm-hmm. But we said, like, hey, we've got 4 weeks till level two starts. Will you keep coaching us? He's like, yeah, okay, because he wanted money.
Right.
And that was huge because that got me in like with the in crowd.
Right. It's
the
interesting.
The in crowd being into improv, not even cool.
Well, it's interesting that you describe it that way because you're saying that there were much less people and everyone that was doing it was kind of very into it. So it must have been easier to have a consistent practice group and kind of come up with people maybe than it is now. I don't know.
It definitely – I mean, I'm not doing practice groups now, so I don't know. It definitely seemed easy. Right. It seemed like a few people had night jobs and that's all you really had to avoid. There weren't – no one was in shows. No, there was no indie scene. So it wasn't like you were performing four other things that week. It was just like – I'm going to either see a show or practice or do my class or be home. Mm. And those are my three options in life, so might as well do a practice group. And so I was in practice groups pretty consistently from then on. And even the times where I thought I was going to be done with improv, I was like, well, I'll do this practice group for a little bit longer. And that would keep me doing it until like all of a sudden I was like, oh, now I need to do more.
What made you think you were going to be done with improv when you thought that?
I finished level three, and I didn't feel good about how I was doing. I felt good in class, but then, like, I was in a indie team, one of the very first, called Hello Magic Susie. with sometimes called Just Magic Susie. We fought over whether to use the full name or not. Chris Gethard does on that team, Jane Borden, Kevin Craig, Mark Sam Rosenthal, other people that I'm forgetting and now will listen to this and be mad that I'm leaving them out. Rebecca Gocher Yagi was on that team, I believe.
Who coached that team?
John Bowie, Rob Corddry. I think Rob Corddry coached Magic Susie the most, which is an amazing get for a coach, yeah. It sounds like, right? He was great. I learned so much from Corddry, John Bowie, and why am I blanking on this name? This is terrible. Edit this out when I finally remember.
We're not capable of editing.
Names. Who else is in Pound?
Jesus Christ. All right,
cool. We're learning a lot about.
Well, anyway,
we
to make sure Will, we could just call him when we're doing the podcast.
It'll come to me later in this podcast. I'll mention. But anyway, it's Naked Babies really more than Pound. We're the guys who like just coached us a ton, and I learned so much from those guys. John Bowie, instrumental. Rob Corddry, huge.
Is Seth Morris, were you there?
Seth Morris, that was the third one. That's what I was trying to think. Seth Morris was immense.
We're gonna be fine.
Those three I used. I still teach from what they taught me.
Right.
Wow.
So I don't know. What was the question? Oh, so they coached that practice group. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel good in that practice group. I felt like the weakest one. I would once in a while have a show where I felt good. And then they had auditions. And everybody from that team except for me and Kevin Craig got on. And I was in another practice group at that time that did not perform. And everybody but one other guy from that team got on.
Woof.
And so I was surrounded, I was like 16 people around me, and like 14 of them got on teams. And I didn't even get called back. Mm. And I was like, oh, I'm terrible. I get it now.
Right.
And I felt good because I was surrounded by such good people.
At that point, how long had you been doing improv?
Just a year.
Right.
And my friend Dave, who was an actor, was like, would point that out. He's like, you haven't been performing that long. Like, you've been doing this for a year. Mm-hmm. Like, I acted in college. I've done plays. Like, and, like, everybody's got things like that. Chris Gethard did it in Rutgers. But, you know how it is when you don't get on. It's right. Like, you don't hear that. I was like, I got heard it. It made sense. I'm like, yeah, I can't overcome that.
Was that also in the early in the audition stage?
It was like, the very first audition.
Yeah, so it's like you kind of have no can't look back and be like, well, that's normal. You're just kind of like everyone around me got put on.
Yeah. And looking back, I think the one thing that I think Dave probably said this to me, but I wish I heard better was that if those people are good and they want to work with you, you can't be bad.
Right.
Like, maybe I wasn't great, but I couldn't be bad, or they wouldn't have wanted to work with me. They wouldn't have kept including me in things.
I do think that's super important to know even now.
Yeah. You just don't want to work with somebody that's not good in scenes. You'll do it for a little while, but after a while you're like, I don't want to be in scenes with this guy. And that didn't happen. I wasn't like being cut out of groups or anything. But it was just hard. It was very hard.
And what brought you back in?
Well, so Magic Susie sort of fizzled out. And I was like, I guess I'm done. But Chris Gethard, Dave Lombard, and I were working like a three-man form. And I was like, well, I'm still doing this, so I don't want to give up completely because this is really fun. And that was with John Bowie. And we rehearsed that a million times we did like three shows ever. We rehearsed so, so much. We had our own form. It was so complicated.
Can you describe it?
Yeah. It was called Hindsight, H-I-N-D, not Heinz Sight.
I wish it was Hindsight.
It's not.
Yeah, me too.
And in the form, we would each play the same person at different ages in their life. So, like, Chris maybe would be this person as a child. I'd be him as an adult. Dave would be him as an old person.
Okay.
And then we would do, like, second beats and third beats of that person growing old.
Oh.
Interesting.
Or just, like, second and third beats of those periods of their life. So it'd be like, second beat of him as a child, second beat of him as an adult, second beat of him, and then third beats.
Oh, that's interesting.
Sort of. That was kind of what the form was.
Mm-hmm. And you could go back and revisit, like,
you'd see how those things affected how he became the person he was later on.
That's very interesting.
And if we were way better, it would have been very interesting. Instead, it was like, okay.
You kind of touched on this earlier, but was the ratio to rehearsal to doing indie shows completely reversed? Like, it was. It seems like it was mostly practice.
There were no. There was very few indie shows. Like, when Magic Susie formed, it was like, oh, we'll do shows sometime. And I was like,
Where?
No one does shows. We're not on. We can't do shows. But I like, it wasn't worth telling that to the person who organized it. I wasn't being like, Jane, no, we're never going to do shows. No one does shows. Mm-hmm. And then she got us shows. So she was right.
Was that other people being involved in the New York theater community?
It was just other improvisers finding spaces. This place, Freaks Local, opened up that just did comedy. And it was sort of like an indie space, and it mostly did improv shows. And it only was around for a short time.
Where was that?
It was up in Hell's Kitchen, like 44th and 9th, 44th and 8th, between 8th and 9th, I think. Tamara Malaga and her boyfriend at the time, now husband, ran it. And I'm blanking on his name, which I should have researched my life. He was very funny. They were both very funny. And they kind of organized this place, and they would do, like, jam shows and just, like, everything. And I think Mother played there a bunch early on. Like, it was a great little venue. And then I think their rent went up, and they had to, like, close it down. And that was, like, the first burst.
Right.
And the second burst was, like, Arthur's Dress Shop and Rafifi and some other places like that. Which I sort of missed the beginning of that because I was in one of my – I think I'm done with this phases. Mm. Or I'm on my way out. I wasn't done with it, but I was, like, heading out. So,
can,
yeah.
Can you talk to us about right before you got on a team and getting on your first team
sure.
and what that was like?
So I had been trying for a long time. I had auditioned 3 times, didn't get called back, and I
– How often were auditions?
Not same as now. Like, once a year there were open call, and once a year there were invite onlys. So there's 3 that I went to that I did not get called back for.
But you did get an invite.
I did not get an invite.
Whoa.
For the one invite that happened during that time. I was in my second level 3 at that time, and I was doing this time. I was having a good class. I felt good about myself for, like, the first time in a long stretch. And a lot of people from that class got called and got put on what ended up being, like, Police Chief Rumble. Yes, Police Chief Rumble. And I was like, I didn't even get called in. I was like, ugh, maybe I'm done. Again, like, right. It was one of those moments of, like, this is it.
Well, especially at a time when you felt good otherwise.
Yeah. I was just like, I don't know if I can do better than this, and I don't know how. And also, like, I felt older than everybody. Like, you know, right. A lot of people feel that. But at this point now, I'm 27, 28. I'm like, and everyone getting on is 22, 23. I'm like, oh, what am I doing? This is, maybe I can't do this. And then I got asked to join an indie team by Sean Taylor called Stomping Ground with Kevin Cragg and a few other people. And I was like, ugh, I don't want to do this. But Sean sort of flattered me. He was like, you're really funny. I want you on this team. I was like, he's like, oh, and Kevin Cragg's on it. He was near level 1. You guys are friends. I didn't really know Kevin Cragg that well. I knew him, but we weren't, like, close. I was like, that wasn't a selling point. But I was like, I'll do this for a few months, and if I hate it, then that's it. This is my last test. And I joined it, and it was so much fun. I was like, oh, yeah. And Kevin Cragg and I are now great friends, I think, because of this team. And Eric Tenoy joined that team 2 months later, and that's how we became great friends. And it was just a blast. And I don't know how good we were. I just knew I had fun in every show. And I was like, well, this is what it is. I'd lost that at some point. I had it in moments in classes and moments here and there. And I was like, oh, this feels good. I feel good in them. I feel like everyone's making me laugh. And, like, we were all very wildly different levels, skill levels. It was a blast. And so then there was an audition, an open call, and I got called back for the first time ever. And that almost felt like enough. I was like, oh, good. And I had my callback, and I had a really great callback.
Was it the same process, just 2 scenes in the first
yeah.
round and Harold's in the second?
Yep. And I had a great callback. I did my scene with Zach Woods. You maybe have heard of him. And I felt very funny in that scene. And, of course, Zach Woods is very funny. Afterwards, I stepped out, and Zach Woods goes, you're going to get on a team. And I looked at Zach Woods, and I just met him here, and I was like, you're already on a team. Like, in my mind, like, he'd been talked about. So, I knew who he was.
He was like a child.
Yeah, but I had heard about him so much from people. I'm like, this guy's already on. I'm not on, he's on. I was in a scene with the funniest guy. So I sort of dismissed it. And I didn't get on a team. Dillinger formed out of that.
Oh, interesting.
And Eric Tenoy was on that team, and I was very happy for Eric Tenoy because Eric Tenoy is super, super funny. A lot of people that I knew that were funny and people I'd never heard of that were all – Dillinger was – oh, I hit the microphone.
It's okay.
I ruined the podcast.
No, it's okay.
And that team was unbelievably stacked. Dillinger was an early Uber team right out of the gate that made everyone jealous, but also they enjoyed watching them. And I didn't get on that team. And Paul Scheer, I think, took me aside and was like, we almost put you on a team, but we couldn't find a spot for you, which was very nice of him, but I found more heartbreaking.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I think that's a thing that gets said and is supposed to be reassuring.
Yeah.
But it is not
what
always.
It sounded like was like, we couldn't find a place for you. So like, so I wasn't good enough.
Right.
If I was good enough, you would have found a place for me.
Yep.
But I was weirdly okay with it. And then like, he told me that. I was like, all right. He's like, I hope we're able to find you a spot sometime soon. And I was like, I'm not going to believe you, I think I told him. I was like, I can't believe that because if a spot opens up and I don't get it,
it would be,
I'll be crushed.
Heartbreaking, yeah.
And so I don't believe you, but thank you for the compliment. I said something a little less composed, but not like break down, freak out. I was just sort of like, yeah, I don't buy it.
Did you really not buy it?
No, I didn't. I believe that he meant it. I believe he meant that I had done a good job, that he noticed me and thought I was funny because I didn't know Paul Scheer that well. So he wasn't like if John Bowie had come up and said that to me, I'd be like, oh, maybe you're just being nice.
Right.
So I believed it was a sincere compliment. But I did not believe I was going to get on. And the next spot that opened up, I did not get.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
So. I feel like that's still a thing people sometimes experience. And each new spot that opens up is like a fresh heartbreak.
Right. And so when that spot happened, I probably felt it a little bit.
Right.
But I wasn't surprised because that's what I expected to happen.
Right.
I got put on the next spot that opened up. Well, two spots opened up maybe a month after that, and I got put on one, and a guy, Flynn Barrison, got put on the other.
Do you know who you replaced?
Yes. I replaced Dave Lombard, my very good friend.
Oh, interesting.
Had quit his team, and I was being put on his team because it just wasn't a good team.
How long was he on that team?
This was his second team.
Right.
And he was on that team maybe 3 months.
Wow.
But he was like, I don't want to be on a team that's not fun.
Now – I feel
and
like
he was quitting this team. And
you
I got,
were like, I'm putting on it.
So I got a phone call from Kevin Mullaney saying, we're going to put you on the Rockets. And I said, oh, I don't know. I said, I don't know.
Oh, wow.
And that was my first offer.
Wow.
I was like, I don't know. And I think that surprised Kevin because everyone's supposed to say yes. But I was like, my best friend is leaving this team. So the only person that I know is not on, has left
right.
this team.
Because it wasn't working for him.
And like, it was a bad team. I was like, I'm going to be put on this team. 4 months later, it's going to get broken up, and that's it? I'd rather never be on a team. And so I said this to Kevin. I was like, I'd rather never be on a team than be put on a team that doesn't get a chance.
Wow. I don't know if anyone would say that. I don't know if that's a thing that would get said nowadays.
That's what I'm curious about. Like, Dave walking away and you saying you weren't sure, I feel like it's the kind of thing now where you'd be like, oh, well, fuck that guy. Would that have been the response then?
I don't know. I wasn't a jerk about it.
Sure.
Because I didn't say no. I just said, I don't know.
Right.
And I was basically like, I want to talk about it. I didn't know. And I was happy on my indie team. I was doing good stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was, in my mind, I was like, if I only do this a few more years.
It'll be fine.
It's not, I got my call back. I think I'm good at this. I enjoy this and I want to keep doing something. But I don't know. I couldn't have that be my mark on the theater.
I mean, you're right. I think sometimes people don't recognize that, like, house teams can be terrible.
They aren't as bad as they were worse teams back then.
Sure.
And this team just wasn't where it was a chemistry issue. There's good people on the team.
But, I mean, it can be a bad experience, and it's okay to not want to do a bad experience.
Yeah.
But I think we don't afford ourselves sometimes that level of rational when it comes
to
house teams.
I think it's a gamble that everyone wants to take, whereas back then it might not have been as good a gamble knowing the teams and knowing your friends
on
the teams.
I think it was basically like I've been dumped too many times. I was like, I don't want to get in a bad relationship. This looks like a bad relationship.
Right.
Like, and they're like, no, it's a good relationship. It's like, I don't know. I just don't want to get hurt.
So you said yes.
So Kevin Mullaney talked me into it, saying like, we're dedicated to making this team good. If it doesn't work, we'll tweak it. We'll change it. We're not going to do the thing you fear, like you'll be done in 6 months and your only experience will have been on a bad team. So I joined the team. It was bad. There was very good people. I really liked the people on it a lot. But the shows were almost always bad.
Even your first show you remember is not a good experience?
I remember having fun in my first show. One nice thing about not getting on for so long is when I got on, I was fearless. Mm-hmm. I was like, sometimes I watch people get put on their first team and they're nervous. They hang back. They're on the back line. They're not stepping, especially when they're added to a team.
Right.
And I'm always watching them like, get out there more. Show, you deserve to be here. And I sort of was like, this is it for me. This might be – I still felt like this team was going to get broken up and I was done. So I threw myself into it. And Eric Tenoy came up to me after the first show. He was like, you were like in so much of that show. I was like, yeah. I've been waiting to do this. I've been waiting for that.
Wow.
And it was fun. I remember doing some really fun scenes with Leslie. I think maybe on the first show. I remember a very fun scene doing with Leslie Mizell that I thought was a blast. I remember doing a fun scene with Eli early on, Eli Newell. That was very fun. But the team wasn't good. We didn't work together. We had bad shows. And people quit constantly. Like every couple months somebody would quit. Dynamo was on that team and was quitting because she was waiting to get moved to Monkey Dick because
mm-hmm.
I think she knew it was coming and quit before that because right. She's like, I don't want to be on this team anymore. People would move to L.A. And so it was just a team that constantly was getting changes. And then we got three new people. We got Neil Casey, Amy Gorlick, and Sean Taylor. And then we became this team called Filth that was okay. That was an okay team. And for me, there was an immense, huge upgrade because it went from a team that wasn't working to a team that could work.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't always. We had great shows. We had terrible shows. We mostly had good shows. And I was like, this is good. If this is my only team, I'm not going to feel robbed.
And that
was 4 months after joining the Rockets.
And then
wow.
You went from the Rockets to Filth to
– Cut.
Wow. Cut.
Yeah, then I got cut from Herald Knight.
So let's talk about that.
That's
yeah. My favorite topic.
Sure. I'm not going to get into every detail about that in a video recording, but I'll get into some of it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Video recording?
Audio
it's
recording.
Not video recording.
Are you video taping this too?
I am not.
That's Ben.
I was promised videotape.
Okay. So is that just because you don't think it's that interesting, or are you drawing an emotional line?
I don't want to say certain things for posterity.
Sure.
I mean, I do think there's a
But level. I will talk about it in general.
I do think
it's more drunk talk, some of it, so I don't want to get into every aspect of it.
Oh, my gosh.
So I'll give the short version, which is we had a bad show, and then afterwards Matt Besser said, this team is broken up.
So you were not cut.
Matt Besser used to come to shows,
right.
Which is also great. Matt Besser would come to shows, Ian Roberts would come to shows, and they would give us notes, and I loved those notes.
Right.
Some people got freaked out by it because it was like I didn't get to take classes with those guys.
Right.
But I got notes from them, and I would eat them up.
So you got cut in one of those, like, nightmare scenarios that get talked about now, like the
sure.
kind of thing that doesn't happen now. It wouldn't happen.
Yeah, this didn't happen then either, but it happened at a time when Owen Burke was – planning his exit from being artistic director.
Right.
The Herald committee was a thing, but that was going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already this transitional time. Besser came. We had an awful show. And he was like, this shouldn't be a team. And based on that show, he's right. I think it was one of
sure.
our worst ever shows. And it doesn't seem fair.
But it wasn't an individual evaluation cut.
No. Our entire team was cut.
Oh.
And then Ryan Carls was on the team at the time, was put back on. I think immediately, and Porter Mason was put back on shortly thereafter. But everybody else was cut, and I think I'm the only other person to ever get back on.
Wow.
If I'm remembering of that lineup. But yeah, so we got cut, and I was mad because it happened so suddenly, and we had like a cage match on the schedule and another show, and we lost those shows. Like, we don't get a last show? And he's like, no. And Owen was like, sorry, no more shows. And I was like, well, that part sucks the most.
Yeah.
And then that should have been it.
Right. I mean,
that's the end of the podcast.
Right.
I never did improv again.
I want to talk about Filth for a hot second.
Great.
You guys did have that. You mentioned cage match, and you guys did have that like epic cage match.
Our best show was at a cage match.
Where you took down Respecto?
We beat Respecto Montalban.
Mm.
Still one of my favorite memories.
One of the greatest.
Because it was a good team, but it was not that good. We were not a Respecto beating team. But it just shows anyone could do it. you could do it if you have a good night and they have an off night. You could beat anyone. Mm-hmm. It was thrilling. We had a show. It was pretty dirty, which is good when you're going up against Respecto, which was a relatively dirty team. And I remember there was a scene about somebody fucking people with keys, a locksmith who fucked people with keys.
Porter.
And Kevin Craig returned a key because it was covered in hymen. And that got a huge reaction. It was really funny.
Wow.
And there was a group game, a sequence of group games where it was like a robbery where cops came in. It was bad cops, basically. But then it turned out it was a training exercise. It was not a real robbery. It was a training exercise, and the guy came in and detailed everything the cops had done wrong. Pretty funny move. And our second group game was a frat party, and they did the same move. It was like, this had been a real frat party. Here's what would have gone wrong.
Mm.
And so at the end of the Herald, the same guy came out and was like, well, if this had been a real Herald, here's where you guys went wrong. And he kind of listed like all these sort of moments that were like basically we shouldn't have done this. You shouldn't. And like it was all in good fun. It was very funny. And I looked at the clock. I was like, we got 2 minutes left. We should do that real Herald now. So we got a suggestion. We did a Herald in 2 minutes. And it was like one line scenes. One of the scenes I think was just a boner getting bigger, I believe.
Heightening.
It was very, very silly. And then I think like the last 30 seconds was just applause.
Oh, wow.
And we went first. And so that was it. We were done. We went backstage and was like, wow, that was great. It was our best show. We knew it. We just had our best show ever. And now Respecto was going to go on and beat us. And they had a bad show, and we beat them. We crushed
them. You can scorch the earth so hard that it's hard to do a show afterwards.
Yeah, I think – and Respecto knew it. Halfway through the show, they knew they were losing, and they were not happy about it, at least on stage. They were very nice afterwards. Will came backstage and said we were going to win. And just like when I got put on, I was like, I don't believe you.
Sure.
It's Respecto Montalban. You can't beat them. And I had gone up against Optimus and International's famous cage match and lost. Have you guys heard of this one?
Mm-mm.
No.
This – I was on Stomping Ground. We did a rare indie team in cage match back then. We faced Optimus International, and we had a pretty good show. Not a great show, but a good show. And then Optimus International had a terrible show. It was just rough to watch. And a lot of the scenes were about women getting beaten and hurt and just being treated like shit.
So it was an uncomfortable show.
It was just not good. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting next to Eric Tenoy. And I was like, we might win this thing. We might beat one of the best teams ever in cage match. I got my hopes up.
Rare time you get your hopes up.
Yeah. And then Jack McBrayer stepped out and said, we've seen women, something along the lines of, like, we've seen women being treated pretty poorly in this show. I wonder what would have happened if the shoe was on the other foot. And I looked at Eric, I was like, oh, we just lost.
Oh, they just did it.
And they redid all their scenes with women getting the upper hand. It was unbelievably funny, unbelievably satisfying, wonderful, perfect. And we lost.
Wow.
We got crushed. And I think it was that. It was just that one line. I was like,
right.
Oh.
There are definitely
he
times.
Knew. He saw what was happening, and he adjusted. And he's a pro. He's amazing, and that's why. And I was like, oh. And it was hard. So when we were beating Respecto, I was like, yeah, we could still lose. It just takes one funny move.
There's definitely times on the back line where I've said or other people have said, just leaned over to me and said, they just won or they just lost. Depending on one move.
Yeah.
I can think of a few that I've seen recently where I'm like, that one move, they just won on that
move. It can sometimes do it, yeah. And that move, I was like, ugh. And it was – I was happy to be there. I wish I wasn't on the other side of the voting.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we beat him, and it was very satisfying to beat Respecto.
And then during your cage match run, you got broken up.
No.
Or was that a different cage match?
That was – Male or Demon was during your cage match run where we stopped being a team.
Oh.
So did you get
– Filth, I think, won the next week and then lost the week after.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you were cut from Filth. That team broke up.
The team was broken up.
And then how did you get back on a team? And was it Male or Demon?
So I was offered to audition again immediately after being cut. And I said no. Because I said, who's going to be at this audition? And it was like a bunch of people who had coached me. And I was like, I don't think I can do that. It feels humiliating. You guys know whether or not you think I'm good. You know I'm into it. I never missed a rehearsal. I'm not like taking this lightly.
You were just on a team.
I was just on a team the day before.
Right.
I was like, and there's an audition in a week because they had to like fill these spots of all these people that were getting cut. I was like, I can't do it. And I knew that we had a new AD coming in 4 months. I was like, what does it even matter?
Mm.
What happens now? I was like, I can't do that. I'm sorry. And so I did an audition, and I think that's when Male or Demon formed, a team I would later join. And then when Anthony King became AD, I went to an audition with him. And I got called back, but not I did not get put on a team.
Wow.
I get rejected a lot, guys. I don't know why. Whenever I go through all this, my reaction is mostly like, I should have quit. Why am I still doing this?
Yeah,
I was going to say, do you think part of it is that like you maintain like a very rational, or at least you claim to, maintain a very rational
sure.
perspective on things that maybe makes longevity more possible?
The irrational parts hit me hard for long stretches where I had no opportunity to be rational. So it'd be like I'd be brokenhearted and upset and
right.
beating myself up and it's all I want and I can't get it. And then I'd get over it. And then I'd get offered a thing, and I'd be like, ugh, I can't.
Right.
It's like I just quit drinking. I can't have a beer right now.
Yeah,
you can't
right.
do this to me.
They keep pulling you back in. It's that.
But now I'm drinking again. So, but yeah, so I auditioned with Anthony. I had a bad callback under Anthony. I remember being in a scene with Jim Santangeli, and Jim Santangeli was so funny and so good. And everything Jim did, I was like, oh, this guy's on. I am terrible. If they put me on – it's out of respect or pity or someone like me from before because I'm not giving them any reason to put me on. And I didn't question it. It was like, yeah, ugh. And then I got invited to an invite only, which was very flattering, only time I ever got invited to one. And I had a good audition. And that's when I got on Male or Demon.
God.
I don't remember if it was great, but I remember feeling good about it. And it wasn't like, oh, I won't – it wasn't I should or I shouldn't. It was just like, that's good enough. And it was one of these things where I was still doing improv, but I wasn't doing Heralds a lot. And I was just like, ugh, I should practice Heralds more. That's what I need to do well in here. Definitely after the one I did bad in, I was like, I got to do Heralds more often.
So there were times where you definitely were like, I got to readjust my approach. Every time you were auditioning, you were kind of coming in with something.
Yeah, I mean, definitely at that point, I could just feel how rusty I was. I was like, oh, it's tough doing second beats when you don't do them all the time. Heralds are like when people don't get on teams or don't get into advanced study – and they don't practice Heralds in their practice groups, that's why. Heralds hard.
It is very hard.
Who were you practicing with outside? What improv were you doing in between?
At the very end, I was just on this team Primal Bias that did not practice, but we did regular shows.
You did the project, right?
We did the project, and then we started doing shows every Friday at
Under St. Mark's. Right. You
and it was a stacked group. We're way over.
No, we should just roll through.
Yeah, we're going to roll through the break.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Sorry for everyone listening. Get comfortable.
No, this is
12-hour podcast.
Take a break. They weren't going to take
might.
A break.
Okay. It's just
well,
so
can.
Interesting.
Can
we can't
stop. Whenever they want.
Primal Bias was a stacked team that Terry Jin had asked me to put together a team for the project, and I asked Kevin Craig right away because he had been cut from Filth with me, and now we're very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I want to make a team. I want you on it. He's like, yes. And I was like, I want to ask all my good friends, but they're all on Herald teams or things. They're going to say no. They're all too. They all complain to me how busy they are. Called up Eric tonight. I'm like, I want you to be on this team with me, but I know you're too busy with Dillinger. He's like, I'll do it. I was like, oh, okay, great. I called up Dave Lombard, who is now teaching at the Pit and on shows there, talking about how he had no time. He's like, I'm in. I'm like, oh, okay.
This is going to sound like a bit. Did you really call them?
Yeah,
on
the phone?
Phone.
Telephones were a thing.
Okay.
And then, what is that? I called Gavin Spieler, who I didn't know that well. But I thought he was so funny. I was like, Gavin, be on this team with me. In my mind, I was like, Gavin will probably say yes because he just got on a Herald team. He's new. Maybe he'll feel weirdly flattered, especially now that I've got other people. Gavin's like, yeah, I'll do whatever. More shows, yes. Everyone says
cool.
yes to doing shows. I didn't realize people just want
right.
to do shows. I was
mm-hmm.
like, no rehearsals? I'm in.
Right.
I was like, oh, okay. So now and I was like, I have one more spot. And I called Will up to ask him to who I should ask. And Will got real quiet, and I was like, wait, do you want to be on this team? Because Will complained to me more than anyone about how he had no free time. He's like, I think I do. I was like, I would have asked you, but I assumed you didn't have time. Will and I had never performed together at this time. I was like, I assumed you didn't have time. He's like, yeah, I don't. I don't have time. And we discussed some people that we were gonna that I could put on Primal Bias, hung up. Half an hour later, Will called me back. He's like, I'll do it. And I was like, great. So that was our sixth person. And that team was super. And then we added Sylvia when we stopped doing the project and started doing Friday night shows. And you can't ask for better than Sylvia.
So you co-hosted with Five Dudes?
Five Dudes, yeah. Primal Bias and Five Dudes.
Under St. Mark's. I just, as like an Under St. Mark's nerd, what was the vibe like there? What was hosting like there? Who went to shows?
I don't know who went to shows. A lot of people. I mean, maybe it's because of the five dudes. I don't know.
Right.
But there weren't as, like, Rogue Elephant did shows. There weren't a ton of big indie shows. This feels like one of the big ones that maybe doesn't get mentioned.
Yeah, I didn't know about it until I looked it up today.
But Primal Bias and Five Dudes, which was Chris Gethard, Zach Woods, Bobby Moynihan, Charlie Sanders, and Eugene Cordero. That's an unbelievably stacked group. I think they were all on teams by this point and all, like, the funniest people in the world. We gave 40s to people when they came. Under St. Mark's did not have a bar. They did not – it was – you packed people in. There was seats were much easier to squeeze people in. We would squeeze them in. We made profit,
aggressive,
big profit every time.
Fire code violations.
Aggressive fire code violations.
Who teched? I'm the only person who wants to hear the answer to that.
Did we tech each other? We maybe just teched each other.
How did you find, like, guest teams? Because there would be one guest team per
show. We'd always get one guest team. Would be with two set teams and one guest team. People who coached would ask the teams they coached.
Yeah.
And we would try to ask people that had never performed or rarely performed.
Right.
Hoping that they would bring the audience. And some of them would. And some of them wouldn't. Brandon Gardner's team, Big Tobacco, I think.
Lydia Hensler?
I think he did that show.
He maybe also, because Mailer Demon and Fwand also did Friday night shows. Mm-hmm. But I believe he did the Five Dudes Primal Bias show. And somebody else did one. There was a one where everybody, the team that went first, walked out during Primal Bias' show to go do another show. Because we and Five Dudes would rotate who went last. And they, like, watched Five Dudes and then left right before our set, which is embarrassing. We were a little irritated. And Chris Gethard sent them an angry email. And Chris Gethard was already Chris Gethard in a lot of ways. Sent this angry email being like, not cool, dudes. And then the next day, I got an apology email from every member of that team. They were terrified that Chris Gethard had, like, they didn't want to be, like, they were like, Chris Gethard will never let us perform again, which is not true. Chris Gethard was just, like, just letting them know they made a mistake. And it was very funny to get all those apologies.
Chris Gethard's disappointment sometimes is
terrifying.
Harsher than a scream or a yell.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to imagine, like, if Delaney had sent me the same email when I started out, I'd have been like, oh, I'm done. Oh, my God. Delaney just ripped me apart.
Especially,
and that's what happened to those people.
Like a not cool. That's the tactic my dad uses, is to call things not cool. That's
and
very
I didn't
effective.
I didn't see Gethard's email. I just heard he mentioned that he did it. And we're like, oh, thank you. That's very nice of you. Didn't need to do that. And then we got all these apologies. And we're like, oh, wow. That makes sense. Okay. But those were fun shows.
Can we jump ahead to Fwand?
Yeah, I want to jump ahead to Fwand.
Let's talk about
Fwand. It's a huge jump, but all right.
Legend. Oh, well, what
no,
would
I mean,
we,
that's fine.
What would we be skipping?
I think
skipping?
Mailer Demon is also
Mailer
a great team.
Of course. But I've got lots of questions about Fwand.
That's understandable. Fwand is also a great team. Mm-hmm.
So Fwand, okay. So what's cool? You're mostly veterans, right? You're all people who've been around?
Yes. Gabrus is probably the newest as far as at UCB on that team.
And you were doing stuff that was hard, that, like, took a lot of work.
Yeah.
I think that's cool, and I don't know that that's as common now, to find people who've been around the block and who want to double down. I think we tend to rest on our laurels now. Is that fair, Sean?
Somewhat.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it's special, I guess is what I'm saying.
One was Chris Gethard was our coach, and Chris was, I mean— Chris is always very good as a teacher, but I think he was in his prime at this moment. I think Chris Gethard was into it. He didn't charge us for, like, the first 3 months because he just, like, was enjoying it so much. And then at a point it came, I was like, I'm, like, low on cash. I need to charge you guys. And we were like, yeah, we're happy to pay you. We would have paid you all along. You're great. You deserve every cent. He's like, I don't want to even ask. I think he almost tried to back out of it. We're like, no, we're going to. Shannon was like, we'll pay you. Right. That's fine. There was a brief period where we were rehearsing for free at the training center. And Chris Gethard was coaching us for free. We had no dues. We're like, this isn't fair. That was a very short period.
Coach, yeah.
Yeah, and the best coach. He was great. And one of the few coaches I had where I felt like he got me. I don't remember specific notes, but he would give me notes. And I was like, oh, yeah, Chris Gethard's been – I've known him forever. He knows me to a T. Once in a while, every now and then, I forget that. And then Chris Gethard will say something to me where I'm like, oh, God, that's – he just – gave me a note on my soul, not on my scene. It's like, yeah, you're right. That's it.
He's really good at that, and I think that's also what makes it. I think that would burn a person out because he does that for everyone.
Yeah, even like people I've known a long time would comment about how I play, and I'd be like, I do that, but like, Like, I often get the, oh, you just straight man a lot. I'm like, yeah, a lot of people do that. Is that all I'm known for? Am I just a good straight man? Because if so, I'm not a good improviser. And Chris Gethard would say things about me where I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
And then I would feel really good about myself. Mm-hmm. Even if it was a negative note, I'd be like, oh, like I felt like a real player, a real performer.
To be seen.
So he sort of motivated you guys.
Yeah. So we were on Mailer Demon, coached by Charlie Todd, and we were great. But we just played strict standard heralds. We would do like 19-minute heralds. It was just game, no talking. Just pure we would emote game out and the audience would enjoy it. There was no scenes. And it was great.
That sounds very impressive. We shouldn't
game
have skipped
calculated.
Over
we were, yeah.
You're like.
But it was. It just felt easy. And
do
I
you
never,
remember what opening you did?
We did the Invocation. Yeah. And when I joined the team, I didn't want to do the Invocation. They were like, we're doing Invocation. I was like, I hate the Invocation. But I don't want my first thing on the team to be, I don't want to do this opening.
Right.
So I was like, I'll do it. And it was so much fun. That team was so much fun. It's so easy. I've never felt as dominant as I did on that team. I felt like we could never do a bad show at a certain. Once we got good, I was like, we'll never do a bad show again.
And were you right?
I can't think of a bad show that we did during our run. We did some reunion shows that were messy, but during that period, I was like, yeah, every show felt good. And then three people left. We added three people and became Fwand. And Gethard had just started coaching us, and he said, you guys should stop doing Invocation. I think you should do the Organic. I think he even said, what opening do you guys like the least? And we were like, the Organic. He's like, great, let's do that. And I think after a few rehearsals and it was going rough and he could tell we were disgruntled, he was like, do you guys not want to do this? And some of us were like, yeah, we don't want to do this. He's like, that's fine. I don't want to coach you if you're not doing this. You just have to get another coach. That's cool. I'm like, no, we'll keep doing it. And I think that was a turning point where we just did it a little longer than
you wanted to.
We wanted to, and then we got good at it. And I don't even know great at that point, but like good enough where we're like, oh, yeah, we can make this work.
I had heard a sort of legend about something Chris Gethard said to Fwand,
sure.
And I don't know if this is true.
Yes.
I think maybe when you guys were doing the opening and maybe it wasn't going very well, did he say to the team something to the effect of, people don't think you guys can do this?
He said, people don't think you're smart enough
right.
to do this.
Yeah, I'd heard that.
Which is not, I don't think was true. I think he had made that up.
But it's like a motivational tool.
Yeah. Gethard coached just like a angry basketball coach.
Which I think is the only way to coach anything.
I don't agree.
it
worked for Gethard, and it worked for us as a team. I don't think it works for every team, but it definitely worked on us. Like, because we did want to prove this. He also told us that we should hate 1985. Or not.
He loves that.
1985.
He loves giving you an enemy team.
No, it was the Shoves at that point. He's like, you guys should hate the Shoves. And I think our reaction was, yeah, we already do. Like, it wasn't a thing
right.
we needed. Like, definitely Gabrus and I were like, yeah. Like, we loved them as individuals and as a team. They were the best team. But we're like, yeah, we want to be better than them. Of course, when they do good shows, we're mad when they do a better show than us. Like, you don't need to tell. Like, he was trying to motivate us in a thing that we were already feeling in our bones. And, like, 1985 formed. I remember going like, ah, Anthony King created this team to defeat us. He needed a team better than us. That was it. Because 1985 came during Mailer Demon. He created 1985 to beat Mailer Demon. Fuck him. That team's like, it was too good. And we destroyed 1985 early
wow.
on.
Because yeah.
they stumbled out of the gate, and 1985 was, Mailer Demon was on a tear. Wow. And then when we became Fwand, he's like, you guys should hate 1985. And we're like, yeah, we do. We hated them when they got formed because we were jealous of how good they are.
That's it. I've always heard that and sort of had it in the back of my brain as like, that's an interesting take on coaching.
It was weird, but I think another team that would have hurt us to say like, you're not smart enough, maybe would have fed into, like, I think it was just sort of like we were already angry and trying
some
to prove
of the
something.
Yeah. on that team.
Definitely
Shannon,
that's my personality,
Gabrus,
being like, I wanted to prove something, and Gabrus did, and Shannon's
having been
fearless.
Cut and,
right.
You know, Gil and Craig don't know what's going on. No.
Do you remember?
But, like, it was just sort of like the people we didn't have any of the people on the team that would get shaken by something like that.
Right.
So it was like, yeah, it worked 100% for us.
Are there any standout Fwand moments that you remember?
There's small ones. We had big shows that were great. We had like the Scab show where we had a walk out and then Scabs took over for our second beats.
Oh,
and
that's
we had
really
like
funny.
Theme shows like that.
That was late, right? I think that was Chelsea.
That was a late era. Yes. It was definitely, I think Porter Mason was coaching us at that time. Gethard had left by that point. But I remember little ones. Like, I remember the first time we would – everything had transitions. No scene ever got edited, so we would transition. And I remember being in a scene where Gil had fallen through a crack in the ground and was falling to his death. And I parachuted in and played my game with him and then flew away on my parachute. He landed in the group game. And I remember that feeling great. It was like my game ended up being like a minute.
Wow.
But it was like
– flawless.
It was during a transition – and if you weren't paying attention, you wouldn't know that was the, it just felt like a new thing, or it felt like a continuation. It felt very fun. I remember the first time vaguely that we did our scenes out of order. We did our second beats in whatever order we wanted. And I could hear the audience, maybe I'm imagining it, but I could hear the audience going, oh, they missed one. Like that sort of
the air leaving.
They missed
the room.
Their first second beat. But like we knew, it's just like the other one dovetailed into the group game so well, we did the other one first. And then we went back and got the other one. It was easy.
Is that something you guys did a lot after
We did
that?
It a fair amount. But I remember the first time we did it, it was like, yeah, and it felt easy. And the fact that it felt easy was good. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time we did our second beats all as a mono scene. Maybe the only time. It was all in a baseball stadium. And that felt really good, too. It was like we had just been working on mono scene heralds. And we're like, so we used a piece of that. And it was just like, oh, that's great just to take that and do it. And like it wasn't something we said, like, let's do that tonight.
Just happened.
It was just a muscle we had worked on. Opportunity presented itself. I think Gabrus made the initial move. And then, like, I remember recognizing that he was doing that. Oh, but my favorite Fawn moment. I know my
favorite
Is it
the Gabrus moment. Group game where everyone froze?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a Gabrus group game.
Oh, well, that's how I have a story.
It was a Fawn group game.
Yeah.
Because nobody – it wouldn't have worked if not everyone did it.
I don't even know who started it.
But – we would just do weird things. Somebody stepped out and just stood and posed. And then someone else came out and posed. Somebody else came out and posed. Somebody else came out and posed. Until we were all on stage posed and realized, oh, we're not doing anything. We're just going to stand here. And some of us were I was in an okay pose, but not a great pose. And I remember hearing Neil Casey laugh, and then Neil Casey stop laughing. And then Neil Casey start laughing, and Neil Casey stop laughing like three times. That felt great because he has a great laugh. And I remember in my mind going, I'm not going to be the one to end this. I don't want to do it. I was like, I'll do this for the rest of the show if I have to. And then I think Gabrus made a move to connect it to an earlier scene. And then like something like we were mice or rats. Like, the exterminator's gone, scatter, and we all ran off stage. And that was our group game, was literally just standing still.
Yeah. I had heard that story
that was a
from
game.
Someone.
Yeah. And it wasn't a game, but it was a group game. It was a palate cleanser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it felt... And you know what I loved about it is the commitment.
Right.
The fact that we all did it and nobody like said like, oh, I need to label this. I need to define this. This needs to be more than this. I need to make a move. It's just like, oh, are we doing this? I'm going to yes and you and also do this.
Was that when Gethard was coaching you? Because that feels like
I think that was maybe near the end of Gethard's
It feels
time.
Like a Gethard thing.
That feels like loyalty to the group over loyalty to the rules.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great team in the sense that, and this is what I try to coach when I talk about real support, where it's like, you don't need to know what's going on in a scene. You just do it. And like, it's like, my teammate's doing this? I got to get out there and do it with them, even if I don't know what's going on, because he's doing it. It's hotspot. I get out there, I'll sing with you, and I'll just stand next to you. And I trust that as a team, it'll make sense at some point. Or we'll just all do it, and it won't make sense, but we all did it, so it works. And Fawn was eight people who always just were all on the same page, even if it was stupid. And it often was stupid.
Yeah.
But it got us – bad shows were covered up by 200% support.
And I think that's probably one of the unifying things for great teams at UCB that I've ever heard about is that unifying support. Even if the show isn't great – technically, there's something to watch.
We definitely had shows where we'd get ripped apart. No game. You didn't do this. You didn't do this. But it'd be like, but it like went over because like we all did it.
Right.
It was great.
Is there anything else in the Kevin Hines backstory you want to talk about until we get into more technical questions? Or
That's a lot. That's a ton
of
stuff.
There's so much
stuff. There's more, but I don't. Nothing I need to.
I just feel like that we could talk about Kevin Hines' history forever. And I'd love to get into some more of the...
What happens when you've been around for 15 years.
Well,
yeah.
It's an amazing story, and I think...
Here's a bit of Kevin Hines history. Sean Diston took my 101
I did.
Class. And first, my first 101 full class.
Wow.
Then he took my first 301 class.
Right.
And when he found out of that, because I didn't announce it at the top of class, but Sean quickly found out he was in my first 101 and my first 301. Sean looked at me and said, I'm going to be in your first ASP.
I said...
I might never teach an ASP. You don't know that. He's like, you will, and I'm going to be in it.
And I think a year later.
And then like a year later, I was doing an ASP or maybe
600.
Slightly
it was a
600. More.
600, right.
And then Sean Diston applied. I was like, well, I have to take Sean because he called the shot.
It was a prophecy.
And you were good. But I was like, more, it was just like, even if you're terrible, I got to take
right.
Sean.
Yeah.
That was an impressive Sean Diston memory, but
that
it,
is a
it
good
was
one.
More about me.
And Sean was also in the first time you taught Convergence, right? You really like Sean.
Yeah,
say it on the podcast.
At that point, I had to.
This is what we're doing.
Say it on the
Sean
podcast.
Sean felt like my lucky charm, and I couldn't say no to him.
Okay. And, well, that's not what we were going
and
for,
it
Sean.
Was.
I don't like him.
I will say that personally, it was
but I feel
a challenge.
Connected.
But yeah, no, you know, that kind of brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about
sure.
in general was just teaching.
Yeah.
And I know it all starts off with coaching, but tell us, I mean, as the academic supervisor,
associate,
whatever the title is, head
associate
of the school.
Academic supervisor.
Associate academic supervisor.
Or you could say academic supervisor of New York. That would be.
Academic supervisor of New York.
Might be easier.
One of the questions that I solicited some questions online, and Dave Murray asked the question, what makes a good teacher and a good coach other than just doing a lot of coaching and teaching?
How do you become a good teacher or coach, or what makes somebody a good teacher?
I think
or coach?
He's looking for attributes, because how do you become a good coach? I think the answer is do it a lot and learn, you know.
Yeah. I think the best coaches and teachers care. They get invested, and that's why they burn out. I mean, they care, and if you care about – you care and you believe in your students. So, like, when I'm watching a student, even if the student has given me reason to think he's not into it or, like, phoning it in or being jokey, in that moment I have to give him all the faith in the world that, like, no, he's really trying his best right here. And if I don't believe that, one, I can't watch that scene. One, I can't note him accurately. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can say, like, that line was jokey, but if I'm like, that line was jokey and you did it on purpose and you know better, whether that's true or not, I don't think I'm there. But if I watch that scene, I'm like, look, that line could work. You know, I know what you were trying to do, but, like, you this scene needs to be grounded. You need to feel that. You need to work on understanding. Like, I have to trust that he wants to do it right.
Do you think there's
– I almost – died right there.
Do you think there's
that, I think so empathy is a big
yeah.
part of it.
Empathy. Do you think that has anything to do with your coming up in the community and the setbacks you've gone through and like being the student who you're like, I don't feel like I'm getting it? Or
I mean, I don't know how good a teacher I am. I mean, I think I'm good, but I have no – I don't know how to judge something like that.
I would say as someone in the community –
I'm not asking for a compliment
okay.
no.
right now.
But you do have to evaluate other teachers.
I do, and I have to just trust that I know what I think is a good teacher.
Right.
Interesting.
I watched other teachers, and it makes me feel like I'm not far off. I do think I'm good. I don't know if I'm a great teacher. I'd like to think I am, but I don't know. It's hard. It's so hard to judge yourself in that. But – everything you do affects how you teach. I think
right.
a lot of people teach to the things they want to be better at.
Right.
Or the things that they focus on when they're performing, the things that they note themselves on or what you're going to note other people
totally,
on.
Totally, 100%.
Whether or not yes. you're good at those things or not. Like I care so much about the acting side of improv because I don't think I'm a good enough actor. And
yeah.
so that's what I notice in scenes. I'm like, oh, if you were acting better,
right.
you'd cover up everything. And if you're
yeah.
super smart, it's like, yeah, yeah, that's easy.
Right.
Because I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you coach to the notes you got the most.
Because
I
they're
think.
The ones that you hear yeah. the most and the ones that you're most easily
and the things
recognize.
You're working
and
on
the ones
yeah.
that
you're
helps
thinking
you the
about
most.
And the things you're wrestling over.
Yeah.
So that comes in. So everything you do builds you up. Empathy is it's hard for me. And I think it's why sometimes when I'm not coaching a house team right now and it's good because when I am – and they do a bad show, it feels like I was on that team and
oh,
did a
yeah.
bad show.
Yeah.
It breaks my heart. And when they do a good show, I'm happy. When there's anchor slots and they get the anchor slot, I'm happy. When they're not getting a lot of shows, I feel it. I'm just like, and I hate when I have to like look at the schedule and be like, how many shows do we have? They have. why do I still care? But I do. I just want them all to be awesome.
It's a totally different way of experiencing improv than I think you think you're ever going to when you start doing it. And it radically changes how you watch
when they're great,
and do it.
There's nothing more fun.
Right.
When a team is like really – I just coached Big Revival and they had stretches. You were on that team.
I was on
Where they, I think you guys were so great and it made me so happy to go to shows and watch you guys do the things I asked you to do and do them well, do them better than I asked.
An opening that you invented.
It was really fun.
And somehow got people to believe it was a pattern game.
Well, it kind of was.
It was a pattern. It was an invocation-infused pattern game.
It's not a pattern game.
It's called the...
There was pattern game aspects.
What is it called?
Yes, there were pattern game aspects.
You called it the Raging Cajun.
The Raging Cajun by Kevin Hines.
Why is it a James Carville reference?
I don't remember.
I didn't name it.
Okay.
I call it an invocation-infused pattern game.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that's a big part of being a good teacher is just caring. And I think... That doesn't make you a good coach, but you got to have that. Because just caring isn't enough.
Right. Well, I think, you know, if you become a coach and become obsessed with it, it's because you care. You know?
No, not always.
Not always?
Sometimes people do it because you get paid.
Yeah.
Sometimes people do it because they think they're supposed to. Or they do it because they think it'll get them something.
Right.
And maybe not consciously, but I think, oh, if I don't coach, I won't get this next opportunity.
Right.
Which is not true at all. And people who do it a lot, you have to love it or you just couldn't keep doing it.
That's true.
So in talking about how invested you get and how attached you get, especially, well, not maybe especially to house teams, but to teams, how do you draw that line, though? Because the team is not yours. It belongs to the team and you can be in it deep, but you're not part of it.
When I first started coaching, I did what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard sometimes when they wanted things that I didn't care about or didn't think they were ready for or didn't want to work on. I found it very hard. Once I'd been teaching long enough and felt like I had the clout, I started just making them do what I wanted them to do.
Because
that's what Chris Gethard did to me on Fuan. He was like, you're doing this opening or I won't coach you. Once I felt like I could do that, I felt like it was much easier.
And people bought
into it. I coached Ragnarok, and they were amazing. They were so good. And they wanted to do an Evente Herald, and I did not want to do an Evente Herald. It's not what I was excited about, but that's what they were working on already, and I wanted to work with them because they were so good. So I did, and I ended up having a lot of fun with it. But I feel like if I coach them now, and they're like, this is what we're working on, I'm like, here's what I want to work on with you. And I'm now more pitch my ideas to teams. Like when I coached Sandino the second time for a very brief period, they said, we want to work on X. And I was like, I don't want to. It's like, here's the sort of opening I want to work on. And they were like, we're on board. And I'm like, great. And then they ended up having to move the rehearsal, so I didn't stay with them very long. But I was like, that's how I need to coach.
Right.
And like when I coached Big Revival or Hotspur before that, I was like, here's how I want you guys to do the opening. And some of your team was like not comfortable with it.
Right.
They're like, I don't know. This puts me in my head a little bit. I'm like, all right, this is how I want you to do it.
Right.
And we even talked at one point. I think you were like, oh, should group games be this way? And I'm like, this is how I want you to do group games. And you're like, okay. Because it's like, if I'm going to coach you, you've got to do it my way at this point.
Yeah.
And trust that I'll make it work. And if it doesn't work, then I'm not the right coach for you. I can't adjust to be a different coach.
I think people.
At this point, I don't want to. I can coach well this way, the thing I'm excited about, the thing I'm interested in. If not, I'll find the team that does fit for. And I think I'd like to think I was very good for Big Revival. I think Hotspur
Definitely.
And I clicked really well while I coached them.
I think it's interesting because as, you know, being on teams, I think with coaches, I'm not necessarily used to the coach dictating what we're supposed to do, you know? And I feel like that might be more of an old school thing. But now I think
most don't.
Right.
I just found that it was the only way I could do it.
Right.
If a team is so veteran that they want to name their own thing, I get it. But I also don't think they can. Because the thing is with eight people, if I'm like, I want to do this and Nicole doesn't and you sort of do.
Yeah.
It creates some slight fractures. But if somebody else comes in and goes, you're doing this, and whether or not one of the three of us agrees or not, you don't blame your teammates. You're like, oh, my coach is making me do this.
Right. I do think
I talked to Kate Riley when Sandino first started doing Organic. She came up to me and she's like, I hate organic. I don't want to do organic anymore. It's not what I like. And I was like, what's your team feel about it? And like, they're all into it. And I was like, all right, you got to do it. Your coach wants to do it. Your team wants to do it. She's like, I know. And she wasn't saying, like, how do I get out of this? She just was venting, I realized.
Right.
She's like, I know, you're right. Kate Riley was the best person on that team at Organics.
But by she
the
didn't time like
I'd
it.
Watch it,
yeah.
I think she learned to love it. It was early on when she said this. I went to the next show and she was unbelievably good. I was like, oh, yeah. And then by the end, she probably loved it as much as anyone. Mm-hmm. It just was, she was uncomfortable, but she didn't have a choice and she went with it. And I think that would have been easier for her to take if it was the coach making her do it more than the whole team being excited about doing it.
So it is, it's a certain amount of like, not taking negative focus, but a little bit, taking responsibility as
hate
the coach.
Me. Don't hate each other.
I do think that's great. Why the analogy of a sports coach, maybe not a basketball coach, but I do think there's something to that.
But I think there's coaches that are nice and there's coaches that are mean.
Of course. And I don't think you need to be mean.
You don't need to be Ted Knight. Bobby Knight Bobby throwing Knight. Chairs.
Okay, well, I didn't get into it.
Ted Knight in Caddyshack.
But I do agree that having a strong enough opinion that the team kind of has to galvanize towards that.
I coached That's Mr. Great. Crime, and I kind of came in and was like, this is how I want to do it. And I couldn't get that team to work. It just wasn't going to work. I don't think for anybody, but I was like, I definitely wasn't the guy to make him work. Right. I couldn't do it.
When that happens, is that like a thing that keeps you up, or are you just like matter of fact about it?
It destroyed me.
Okay.
I hated that team didn't work because I loved – those guys were so good individually.
Yeah.
And when I coached Robert Barron because I loved you guys.
Yeah.
I was like, this team should be the best team at the theater. Look at them. And I couldn't get you guys to work. And that was the beginning of a string of me coaching teams that didn't work. And I was like, oh, I'm a bad coach.
God, I'm so sorry.
Because you guys were so – I loved you as individuals. Each one of you could make me laugh easily. And as a team, the shows were bad.
Yeah.
Even
were they?
Sometimes
were
rehearsals
they
were good. Sometimes rehearsals were good. I think you had like one decent show under me.
Jesus Christ.
You had lots of good rehearsals and lots of great scenes.
Yeah.
But very few good shows. And I think you guys started doubting yourself and destroying yourself. But like maybe I came in too late, but I was like, oh, maybe I'm bad. And then I coached Monstro, and Monstro was good, but never great, and they should have been great.
But that was also a team that was together a while before you coached them.
Yeah, and then I coached CAPTCHA, which is what Monstro became, and they weren't great. And they were good. Those teams were good.
Yeah.
But I looked at that lineup and I'm like, these guys should be great. Look at these guys.
I guess that's kind of a thing is like, as individually everyone could be great, but these teams always come down to chemistry.
You just don't know. I mean, Mailer Demon was a good team, and then Johnny Gabris. Johnny G and me joined that team, and shortly after we became great. It was just a chemistry thing. It wasn't like, oh, John and I were so good. It was like we were the pieces they were missing that got us to being a great team.
Mm. And how important are those first couple months? Because I feel like if a team decides they're bad, that's a hole that's hard to get out
of. If a team starts fighting and not liking each other, you're in bad shape, and I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know if I've ever seen a bad team get good without at least a tiny lineup change.
Because DeCoster's the classic example of that.
Jim Santangeli joined, and then they started getting better, and then they got great. They weren't.
Also Drysdale coaching.
Also Drysdale. That's like another big coach.
Yes, Drysdale's a huge part of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think if Drysdale coached them and there wasn't a lineup change, that
wouldn't
matter. There's no way to know. But I don't think it could have worked. And they maybe would have gotten better. But they were great for a while. And it's just like you need those slight tweaks sometimes.
My dad has a saying, the second time I'm talking about my dad on the podcast, he's going to be really happy, that the rules of the game are the rules of the game and you can't change the rules unless you change the game, which means
sounds like a lyric, but I like it.
Yeah, my dad raps. basically, that like you can't just wake up and want to be different. Something has to change that makes the board or the landscape feel different so that you can then start to operate differently.
Well, I think
that's right.
Yeah. I mean, like, look at Robert Barron. And this, I'm not saying, let's say you remove one person from that team and replace them. Maybe that team then could start working.
Yeah.
Maybe there's another person you'd replace and wouldn't have an effect. But, like, that could be enough. Two people... maybe three people, almost definitely.
Right.
The pieces were there.
Right.
Robert Barron just had, I mean, I think the future of the UCB long form podcast will be dissecting why Robert Barron didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone on that team was great.
Yeah, but
and
everyone
I will never
was...
listen to anyone who says otherwise.
I will say this every time Robert Barron gets brought up. First show, saw it. Afterwards, Will Hines at McManus said, "That's the new Fuand."
That's not true.
Ask him.
That's not true.
I was at the show. Your first show was really good, and Will said,
"I also watched Independence Day." You know the movie Independence Day with Will.
Yeah,
and Will turned and said, "This is the greatest movie I've ever seen." So, which he regretted, I think.
Oh, that's
if not
so
that
funny.
Night, the next day, So that's Will gets swept up in things.
Can I ask another Twitter question? And this is maybe for some of the younger people listening. Younger. I mean, people in the lower levels of
so
the
younger
classes.
Than me? So we're talking 30s. Yeah, we're talking late 30s. Great.
Nicholas DG at end each. I don't know how to spell it. It's
don't
crazy.
Do the whole handle.
Don't do the whole handle. At END. All right. He wants to know, what makes the jump from 101 to 201 so difficult? And what's the best advice you'd give to someone that's in their head in 201?
I'll answer the second part first.
Great.
Just let go. Stop trying to figure it out. Because it's just like you're in your head. The only way out of your head is to stop thinking about it and just be okay being bad for a little bit.
Right.
Then you can get in your head again a little bit. But right now, just let go. The jump is 101 is all about – the main focus of 101 is making you comfortable with improv.
Right.
So that's fun. Get up and make a fool of yourself. Good, bad, who cares? Just do it. That's 101. 201 is let's get good.
Right.
That's hard. It's like, hey, let's play chess. Move the pieces wherever you want. Great, you're moving pieces around. You're good at chess. All right, now let's follow the rules of the game.
Right.
Ugh, this is hard. And, you know, in 101, you might say, like, pawns should only move up one space or two sometimes, and knights should only move in L's. But you didn't do it this time. Who cares? It was fun anyway. You won the game. But 201 is like, no, you can't move your piece that way.
Can you?
And that's hard. That's much harder.
Yeah.
And we're not expecting you to be a great chess player. We're just expecting you to now be aware of those rules and be working at getting good at those
Start
rules.
Start learning.
That's where it gets exciting.
Can you address this? Because I hear this a lot, and sometimes maybe when I'm coaching or coaching teams, if they're working on something, I'll hear like, you know, I don't really like it. This is hard. I don't like it. And a lot of times I feel like that's when it's time to shift into something else. Where I think for me, I always think if it's hard, I think it wouldn't be worth doing if it wasn't hard.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's related to this kind of getting into 201 is the hard, you know, it starts getting hard there.
The hard is what makes it good.
Right,
if it wasn't hard, everyone would do it.
It's I mean, 201 is a lot of people take 201 and drop out because they're like, oh, I like it. I don't want to work at it. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with that. That's sort of what 201's there for. It's like, hey, man, you got to work at it. Yeah, I think it's tough. I remember teams saying like, oh, we don't want to do this opening. We're not good at it. I'm like, if you like the opening, get good at it. Like,
right.
That's not a good reason to stop doing it. But if two or three people don't want to try and it's like you got to switch it up, I guess. But, like, I would hate to move on from something until I've gotten good at it. I hate, like, I've been on teams definitely where we've worked on something and never quite done it well and then moved on. And I'm like, oh, I wish we could have done it. So Ragnarok doing this Evente Herald, you know, they struggled with it. They struggled with it. And we've been doing it a while, and I was like, we got to move on. It's starting to hurt them. And I was like, I wish they had one great one. They'd had some good ones, but I wanted one great one. And in my mind, I was like, I remember before a show, I was like, two more. We'll do it today. We'll do it next week. And after today's show, I'm going to tell them next week's the last one. I made that decision beforehand.
Right.
Didn't tell them yet. They did a great one. And I felt so much better to go and say, you guys nailed it.
Let's work.
This is exactly what
else.
We're doing. We'll do one more next week, and then we'll switch it up. And they wanted to switch it up.
Right.
They were a pro team. They were not going to ask to switch it up. But I could see their faces being like, oh, good. And they also were like, oh, good, we nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew they nailed it. It was a good one. And again, they'd had good ones, but we knew there was a great one in there. And that feels so good to have that great one.
Mm-hmm. Do we have time for one more question, Ben?
We haven't been recording for the last 20 minutes.
Oh, no, this is a disaster.
It's real tape, right?
Last question is from Curtis Rutherford, friend of the show. Great friend of
Friend of the first episode?
Friend of the first episode.
Let's see if he listens to this episode
before
we call
him. He wants to know, are there any exercises that aren't in the – like, what are your favorite exercises that aren't in the curriculum? And, you know, describe
Oof. All right, let me think.
Because I'm sure
I'm not a huge
lot.
Exercise guy, I'll be honest. I like just doing scenes with goals. But my favorite exercise that I like to do with people is where I make people I feel like I've probably done this with you, Sean. It's an exercise where I make somebody do a scene, and halfway through the scene, one of the people has to make a huge offer,
yeah.
Like a crazy offer. Like, so halfway through the scene, it's a sweet scene. We're watching home movies. And all of a sudden, I'm like, let's go rob a bank. And I like the other person to not say yes or no, but just to consider it for the rest of the scene. Because I think a lot of improv, a lot of good straight manning definitely is like you never fully say one or the other so that you can do whichever it needs to be. Like that scene, you probably want to go rob the bank. But if you just say yes, that feels fake. And if you right. just say no, that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the consideration. I love that person sitting there going, oh, maybe we should. And it comes from a scene I did a long time ago with Dave Lombard where I literally used the example. We were just doing a diner scene. I was like, hey, you want to rob this diner? Because the scene had sort of stalled out and I was just making a big move to get it going. And Dave, who was just doing a casual moment, all of a sudden got real serious and looked at me and was like, yeah, I've been thinking about that. And we both sat there and for the rest of the scene just talked about, like, we can't do this. We're not bank robbed. We can't rob a diner. But we could. It'd be easy.
Yeah.
We see how to do it. We're thinking about it. We've cased the joint.
Yeah.
Like, we had figured it out, and we just kept going back and forth. So the two of us were doing that move. And it was – I remember that scene being, like, an early scene where I was like, that felt great.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard for people to do that. They want to say all yes or all no.
Yeah.
And the fun is I often call it show your work. Maybe other people do too, but like you can say no and you can say yes if you show me how you got there. So like if in the middle of a scene, Nicole's like, I want to shoot you and I want to say yes, you should shoot me, which why would I ever say yes to that? But I want to say yes. All I have to do is show the work of my character coming to that decision. I can't just say yes, but I can be like, yeah, I don't know. You need to get this off your chest though. All right, I'm going to let you do it. Even though it's not a great justification, I'm out loud. You're seeing my character come to grips with the decision.
Well, you're kind of like exploring, right?
Yeah, I mean,
in a way,
is it to show that there's like a person inside that character, that there's someone at home upstairs?
Yeah, even if that move is not great that gets you there, it gets you closer.
Yeah.
And a little bit easier to watch that person and be like, all right, I don't buy it completely, but I believe he's trying to make me buy it, so I buy it. Yeah, right. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if it's a good – it's not even about justification. I think justification is overused.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's not about justifying why I would let you shoot me. It's just showing that I'm open. And also if I just say no, the scene's over.
Yeah.
Like, you know, using the bank robbery thing, it's like, hey, Sean, you want to rob this bank with me? And you're like, nah. All it's going to be is me going, come on, let's do it. Let's do it. No, I don't want to. Why would I do that? We'll go to jail. It's hard. It's not fun.
Mm-hmm.
But if you show me, I could use the money. No, I can't do it. That's all. That's all I need. I got a crack. There's a thing in there. I'm like, oh, I could get Sean to rob this bank with me. Or like just talking like politics with people or hot button issues. Like they don't listen. No. I feel this way. But I feel like there's a moment where like, oh, I could convince them. Now I'll never give up. And that's what you need. You need that crack. So that's what that exercise was always about. So the person would make the big choice and the other person would have to – and obviously in a good scene, you'd probably settle on something and go forward. But I just wanted to watch the cracks form and watch them go waffle back and forth. It's really fun for me to watch.
Yeah, that's great. I love that.
Yeah.
Any other final thoughts, Stressful? Kevin, any final thoughts for the young listeners out there?
I don't think this podcast is going to make it.
It's probably not going to make it.
Jesus Christ.
I
feel like Curtis Rutherford's the only guy I ever hear about listening.
Well, you know, if that's who
he's the only longtime fan. You need more longtime fans to make it.
Well, hopefully we'll get some.
No, I feel like I'm flattered to be the first guest. I think you guys are perfect hosts.
Oh, well, thank you.
I was very excited when Nicole told me that she was doing this with you, Sean.
Thank you.
I wouldn't have picked you two if
fucking Christ.
Like if someone said pick two people, I wouldn't have been able to come up with names, but I heard those names. I was like, yeah, that's it. Those are the guys that should be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited it's happening.
Well, Kevin,
let me get the compliment all the way out before you hear the first half. And
might also be our final
episode.
She just
tattooed the first sentence.
It's pretty permanent.
I wouldn't have picked you is all Nicole wrote down.
Well,
that's all I hear.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Obviously, there are shows we can see you doing.
Curfew
every week, Saturday at 7:30, right?
That's right.
And Play-by-Play once a month, Wednesday?
First Wednesday of every month at 10:15 at UCB East.
And that's an amazing show where you get to see the insights of what Kevin Hines is thinking about while watching improv.
That show is literally me just saying what's in my head at every moment.
Man, we could do a whole show on just that show alone because it's so funny. Anything else, Kevin, other than that?
Hey, guys, keep at it. I don't know. As a teacher, work on heralds. I know it's hard. You hate them, and I know you hate pattern games. And just love them. Learn to love them. Also, don't do it because I'm telling you to. Learn to love it.
Right.
The thing you hate, Sean was saying, if it's hard, get good at it and learn to love it. Like I said, when I started doing invocation, I hated the invocation. I was like, we're going to do invocation. No. I love the invocation now. Do organic. I don't want to do the organic. I love the organic now. Learning to love it makes it so easy.
Right.
Learn to, you know, you love improv, right? Love all of it.
Right.
Love openings. Love not doing openings. Whatever you don't like, love it.
I think that's great advice. That's great advice. Great. So, Nicole, would you like to black out this scene?
Oh.
That's Ben's whole job.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. And we'll see you some other time.
Oh, is that what you meant? You
didn't
mean
button. That's what I meant. No.
I gotcha.
Goodbye.